From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection was made 24 hours ago when local public defenders and community members took to the streets to demonstrate for the Black Lives Matter movement. The protesters marched from the public defender's office to the public safety building. As reported by WXXI's Noel Evans, it was one of many public defender-led protests across the nation yesterday, where the demonstrators called attention to the systemic racism and police violence that they see in their work. In November, a new association called the Black Public Defender Association, or BPDA, was formed. The goal is to recruit, retain, and support Black public defenders. In an interview with The Appeal, one of the founders of the BPDA, Patrice James, said, quote, "The people we are serving are majority Black and brown, and in many jurisdictions, majority Black. But yet we are not represented in the courtroom. Where you often do see people of color in many of these offices are on the support staff level, and that is fine, but we should also be in those other positions." End quote. Local African Americans, public defenders agree with this statement. In Monroe County, former public defender Daniel Ponder has rejoined the office as a diversity and inclusion officer to help the organization recruit more attorneys of color and engage with the community. She helped lead that protest yesterday and reached out to us, along with her colleagues, to share the challenges they face in their work and the reforms they want to see in the criminal justice system. We always appreciate having Daniel Ponder on the program. Daniel, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And also with us is Natalie Knott, who is an assistant public defender with the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Evan.
And Catherine Ejimadu is an assistant public defender with the office as well. Catherine, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Well, we lost Danielle. We'll get her back in just one second here. But Natalie, let me start with you here. When it comes to what we need, what you think this community, I say we sort of as a society, but let's start with what this community needs, maybe, and then we'll broaden it out to society. What are the goals, the tangible goals that you think are within reach now to change, or do you think they're within reach? Go ahead, Natalie.
Thank you. I think the tangible goals that are in reach are dramatically shrinking both the size and scope of responsibility of law enforcement. Currently, we treat almost every social problem by sending someone with a badge and a gun and threat of a cage to go deal with it, be that homelessness, poverty, relationship violence, all of those things which need far more nuanced responses are treated the exact same way as a bank robbery. And that's not a very efficient way for a society to run. It's also not a way for a society to run that is actually trying to address the root causes of really big, really scary problems. And I think that there is a huge amount of room right now for us to dramatically rethink about how we address our big societal problems that have not been in any way solved or helped or fixed by throwing law enforcement at them over and over again.
Okay. Catherine, what do you think?
I think, first of all, I think Natalie Ann did a wonderful job at, you know, artfully and articulating, you know, the real root of a lot of issues, pretty much, and that barrier between police officers and the community, our community, Black and brown community. After time and time again having these interactions when, you know, they're not pleasant interactions and they're not interactions of general welfare, you know, there becomes a distrust, and that breakdown is essential, because that's what an issue is right here, present today, is the breakdown of trust between the community and the police. We don't look at them as, you know, someone who is responding to emergency. We look at someone who is prosecuting and trying to take you away from your family. So, again, I think, you know, Natalie Ann did an amazing job crafting that. Another issue that I think is what you mentioned earlier, Evan, is pretty much the representation. The reality is this. I can't give out percentages, but I will just speak in truth. The jails are filled with our people, and we're not those people aren't represented by their people. So what I'm trying to say is that there needs to be more of a representation of Black and brown attorneys. We do need coalition. We do need recruitment. We do need for our clients to know that we're here. We're present and we're ready to fight for them. But oftentimes we're not represented in these offices. So again, there's a distrust between the public defender's office and the community, which are our clients. So if they don't see people like them fighting for them, then what do you think is in the thoughts of, you know, our clients?
Let me bring in Daniel Ponder, who I think, you know, when we talked last week, we talked about some of the themes that we're already exploring this hour. And one of them that Natalie mentioned, dramatically changing what police officers are asked to do. I want to talk a little bit about this. And Daniel, I want to get yours and all of your co-panelists' thoughts on a debate that is roiling in this community. In Minneapolis, they voted to defund police. The term that we're hearing most often now is defund police. Now, for a little while, we heard abolish police. And often when I hear abolish police, it's followed up by the person saying that I don't mean no police at all. I mean dramatically change the mission, scale back what police are asked to do. In some ways, that might mean removing any sort of tactical or military style gear. It might mean removing weaponry almost entirely from officers for most of their work. It might mean a dramatic change in the way that officers are trained to view their work as sort of battle and warfare. But it doesn't usually mean full-scale abolishing, as in we're on our own and we'll take care of ourselves. I know some feel that way, but typically when we hear abolish, it means some kind of scaled version of defund and reform a mission. I do think the language matters because I think right now the public needs to know what people want to do specifically here. Danielle, what term sort of do you prefer, and what do you think we're moving towards if this community or others are moving in the way that Minneapolis did? I mean, is it sort of a defund and reform model?
Yeah, I understand that language is very powerful, and it can be very difficult for people to sit with this ideal that of abolishment. What I think that means is defunding and reinvesting in community alternatives to public safety. And I'll be honest with you, Evan, in some plans and some vision, that may mean we don't have police officers as we know it. But what our community really wants is a system that reacts and protects them, right? What our community really wants is a system of public safety. We have been told that there is only one way to have public safety, and that's through police. But I know for certain that the people who have created the internet, the people who have gone to the moon, can reimagine other ways. I personally like the word reimagine because I believe it's a hopeful word. I believe it's a positive word and encourages people to not think that there is only one way to deal with crime. I think when people hear abolish, they think, oh, okay, so crime's just going to happen and we're not going to do anything. But that's assuming that police are the only way you can deal with it, right? And so I think defunding, reimagining is about let's create new systems that are actually effective.
Okay. Rob Turner is also with us, Senior Assistant Public Defender with the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Rob, first of all, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Can you elaborate on what you heard from Daniel Ponder there as we talk about the different specific reform calls and what it means to defund or reform?
Yes, I can. So I think it is, like Danielle said, it's about reimagining, and exigent circumstances can bring on the impulse or the insight that we need to reimagine. We look at the pandemic and how it shut down the court system, and in the process of reopening, we've reimagined how we conduct courts. So now we're doing a lot of Skype appearances. And even after the courts have opened up fully, that will probably continue in large part, which means people don't have to trudge downtown to come to court. They can just appear on their phone for routine court appearances. So I just think we can apply that same type of thinking to law enforcement. And ultimately, I think as a community, what we want is we want police to serve justice in our community and to protect us the way they protect the white communities. We don't want them to be an occupying force. And that's the paradigm that has really grown up over the last several decades, especially with the so-called war on drugs. So I'm glad to be a part of this discussion. And in terms of getting down to the specifics, I know we have some great minds in this community, but we have to make sure that they're at the table when we get down to the nitty-gritty of how we're going to implement this reimagining.
So, Rob, let me follow up with you and really with all of you. And I'm I try to be careful not to amplify voices that are either obviously sort of provocative just for the sake of it, or, you know, way off the map in terms of what anybody really actually wants. But here is a short video with 6 million views in the last 24 hours. It's, I don't know where this dude is from. He's in front of American flag. I mean, on Twitter alone, 51,000 likes in the last 24 hours. And what he's saying in this rant is, if you defund the police, we will take matters into our own hands. He's a white guy, by the way. We will defund, you defund the police, we will take matters into our own hands. And we don't use rubber bullets. We have real guns. We don't use tear gas. We've got the real kinds of weaponry. So you want to get rid of police? You're going to have to deal with us. And a lot of people are loving this. I mean, to me, what it actually sounds like is, if you get rid of law enforcement, we're just going to, you know, decide with it who we want to kill or have violence against.
That's exactly what it sounds.
As if there's anything in, you know, this is the last thing in between that level of violence now, and people are agreeing with this. So Rob, in the world in which you can envision, in which police have been dramatically changed in the mission, the approach, the training, sometimes the gear, the weaponry, et cetera. And you've got people out there like this who apparently aren't just a fringe view. It's this idea that you defund the police, now we're in charge. You know, in one sense, I think, Rob, boy, at least we're revealing just the depth of the racism in this country. But in another sense, I wonder how serious people are. You think that's mostly bluster, or how serious is that, Rob?
Well, it sounds like he's a fringe white militia type of guy. Probably the same mindset that led to the gentleman to chase down the brother in Georgia and execute him.
Mm-hmm.
So we're definitely going to have to deal with those types. We know they're armed to the teeth. We know that they're throughout America, north, south, east, and west. But ultimately, we want to have control over our own communities. And even those of us who don't live in the inner city, wherever we live, whether it be the suburbs or wherever, we want to be safe. So we're not going to allow ourselves to be subjected to a militia type mentality, but we're going to have to figure out a way to counter it. And I encourage everyone who can do so to consider getting a gun permit and arming themselves. I think that's the next step, is that many of us who can legally obtain a weapon will probably have to do so and be prepared for whatever happens. I'm not trying to be apocalyptic. I'm just trying to be realistic.
Wow. Catherine, do you agree?
In some ways, and respectfully, not in others. When we talk about the police, and, you know, we're talking about defunding the police and, you know, reimagining that, and look what COVID has done. And yes, we are progressive and we're using our imagination and we're being creative and we're moving forward. But the fact still remains, we have a major issue with the police, the over-policing of black and brown people. My concept of it is, the police is the long arm of prosecution. Okay, prosecution, they use the weapon of the law. We're talking about legislation. We have to be vocal in changing the law. We have to gather, we have to petition, and we've shown as a nation that we can do that. We can demand change. We have to vote and exercise our right to vote. Those people who are far left and want to take things into their own hands, they've always existed. They've always existed. All right. You've mentioned it before. This is shining a light on those people. And now they can walk freely with their biases and their racism and their discrimination. But they've always existed. But what the issue is the law. The law gives police unfettered access to black and brown people. And we all know it. It's ridiculous. The vehicle and traffic offenses. When we talk about probable cause, no bail on bike, these are the issues every day apparent in black and brown communities that give police officers justification to capture them and take them away from their communities and their families. That's a problem. That's the problem. We have to do a better job at bridging the gap, bringing the powers that be to the same table and hashing this out. But we have to delve in truth. We have to do away with isn't working. It's not working.
Natalie Knott.
Right on.
Yes.
Can you respond?
Sorry. Yeah. I will comment on this. I don't think that any of the
you know, black community who is urging for a radical reformation of law enforcement is ignorant to the fact that there are going to be a certain segment of the community, and many of them coming from law enforcement themselves, who are going to take that as a cue to behave violently towards people pushing for this or other things. I don't think anybody is deluding ourselves about that. However, part of a radical reformation of law enforcement is also making sure that we are getting those officers who believe that out of law enforcement, and making sure we have a law enforcement that will hold people accountable for hate crimes, for violence, for racially based violence, which, as we can see, it goes unpunished all the time. And so that is all a part of the project.
Daniel Ponder.
Even minor things as being transparent with police, with their transcripts, with their records, all of that is sealed. But you're here to protect the community, but you keep these things from the community. How do we feel safe? Mm-hmm.
Daniel Ponder, what do you think?
I mean, I think that white terrorism has always been in reaction to black freedom. This is nothing new. I'm not shocked by his statements. It's interesting to me how we forget history and slavery. We had a whole war, segregation, white militias. The KKK was formed and decided that they were going to police black communities. They were going to lynch and kill and terrorize black communities. So we have never had a moment where black people asked for freedom and white people did not respond with terror, or a segment of white folks didn't respond with terror. So I'm not shocked by it. We press on like we always have. We fight on like we always have. And nothing's going to stop us from getting justice, period.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I think it's also important to follow up, Danielle, on the point about what we do expect officers to do. And I now want to reference a couple of comments from white police officers from Ohio who I think I've been reading some of their stuff. I think they are very much good faith officers. They've been speaking out about the importance of not treating their line of work like it's a war. And they think there is a culture problem. So a couple of guys happen to be brothers in Ohio, but they did challenge in a thread that I was reading and sort of jumping back in and forth on, they challenged the idea not that police should do less, but that we have to define what a mental health call is, because someone said, well, police shouldn't do mental health calls. And they said, well, what does that exactly mean, though? Is it a domestic violence call? Is it a different kind of call? I mean, where's the line where you want to start saying, and I'll start with Danielle on this, where's the line where you want to say, hey, from now on, this is not a police call. This goes to this department, or this goes to this kind of specialist. We can't ask police to do everything. How do you draw those lines, Daniel Ponder?
Well, I want to be very clear. First, I want to say I think everyone on this panel, they have different views about defunding or abolition. So we're not, one collective voice on this.
And I think that's healthy.
Many of us are coming to our own understanding. But I do want to push back a little bit and say that it is not our job to come up with a plan in 5 seconds in my head in regards to defunding. We hire politicians. We pay them to do this work, to look at things strategically. So I've been getting a lot of the questions, well, what about this? Well, what about that? We have developed tons of programs throughout our history as a people.
Right.
And what we did? We came together as a community. We spent time. We brought in our politicians. We brought in our community leaders. We don't have to have all the answers right now. But one thing that people can't answer is, why do you continue to give $100 million to a system that doesn't work?
That's the question. That's the question. And to piggyback off of what Danielle said, oftentimes, we're left holding the bag to figure it out. And then even when there's a solution presented, people of color aren't even in the positions on which they already provided the answer to. This is the problem. When you go into institutions, when we're talking about school, when we're talking about work, we're talking about so many different avenues, how often do you see a person of color in those positions? But people of color ensure that non-people of color stay in those positions. We know what works, but oftentimes we're not in position to actually help it and carry it and see it through.
And Evan, let me just add so that folks can take away feeling like, well, that, you know, that wasn't really answering the question. But I really do want to change the tone of how we approach activists or how we approach people in the community with these questions. Well, what do you want us to do, right? As if we haven't hired people to figure this out, called, you know, politicians or whatever it might be. So I just looked at the RPD budget. The majority of the crimes that Rochester Police Department is prosecuting are property crimes. So the taxpayer has to ask themselves, do they want to spend $100 million protecting property? A good portion of those property crimes are petty larcenies. And any public defender can tell you that most petty larcenies are not personal petty larcenies. They actually are someone stealing from a corporation. And any public defender can tell you those corporations have a civil route to, one, ban the person from their store, and two, to go after them civilly for the amount, right?
Yes,
so
do.
I want to give you those examples just because we do have some firsthand experience. The other thing we know about property crime, which is the number one crime in Rochester, is that a good portion of those individuals are struggling with drug addiction. So what do they need? Do they need more jail or do they need rehab centers? I had a client with 90 petty larcenies. Mm-hmm. And on the 91st time, I said to the judge, are we going to send him to jail again? Because if he doesn't get the treatment he needs, he'll be out and he'll be committing those acts again. So what the Rochester community really needs to know is where your tax dollars are going. You may have the assumption that RPD is going out and arresting all of the murderers, and every day they're dealing with murders and rapes. That's not the fact. They're more likely to be stopping someone for marijuana. They're more likely to be stopping someone who stole something from Family Dollar. So we have to have a really good sense of where the money is going. So I want to add that kind of firsthand information to help the community understand.
Okay, let me see if Natalie and Rob want to weigh in here.
Yeah,
go ahead, Natalie.
I would love to. Okay, so I'm having a little bit of a unique perspective. I wasn't born and raised in Rochester. I was born and raised on the West Coast, the Los Angeles County area. And one thing that struck me when I moved to New York, because I lived in New York City for several years, and then I've lived in the Finger Lakes in Rochester for the last almost 8 years, is how much of, I guess what I would call affirmative policing. I live in the area of Plymouth, around the intersection of Plymouth and Jefferson, and every single time I leave my home, be it in a car or on foot, I see a police officer. If you count up the amount of law enforcement agencies in Monroe County, it is staggering. There are layers and layers of law enforcement out there affirmatively stopping somebody, not waiting for calls for people in distress, but affirmatively stopping people, affirmatively searching people. And it is, it's honestly, truly shocking. If you go to the West Coast, it's not like that. Police respond to calls for help and you see some patrols, but it's not to the degree it is here. I also hear a lot of people in New York, I'm sure you've seen many shows on complaining about taxes. I would implore everybody to go look at their municipality's budget, look at how much is being spent on law enforcement, and then look at your county budget and look at how much is being spent on law enforcement, and then look at the state budget and look at how much is being spent on law enforcement. New Yorkers are paying an astonishing amount of money, as Danielle said, to largely deal with low-level property crimes. I mean, I've had multiple cases of petty larcenies that are, you know, under $10. And when you think of all the court staff and the jail staff and the law enforcement staff and my salary and the district attorney salary that is largely going into that work, that is an astonishing waste of resources. What that could be put towards actually helping people get better, helping people have housing, helping people not have to steal food.
Rob, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so it all comes down to what is our mission and what is the mission of law enforcement. And unfortunately, the mentality has been that we have to be overly aggressive. That leads to basically a de facto stop and frisk environment where officers can approach people, go through their pockets. Another big category of so-called crimes are drug possession, whether it's marijuana or harder stuff. So police can go through people's pockets, then they write up the police report to to indicate that there was some furtive movement on the part of the person that gave rise to the need to search them. And oh, lo and behold, drugs are discovered. And now the person has another charge because the police know that the district attorney's office is going to back them up. And they know that by and large throughout the court system, you don't have a lot of judges willing to make the tough calls in terms of the probable cause issues once the defense attorney asks for the suppression hearings. So again, there's a whole linkage between the police department, the district attorney's office, the Monroe County Jail. Again, it's us and our client against the world. That's how we all as public defenders look at it. And we're taking on the whole entire criminal justice system, or the police state, if you will, whichever term you prefer. And all those forces are arrayed against our client. And it's us and our client standing up, and we're trying to give our client the best representation. But it's the underlying mission and mindset behind these other institutions that creates these circumstances. And that mindset needs to change. And hopefully this groundswell is part of starting that process.
Listeners, you're hearing Rob Turner, Catherine Ejimadu, Natalie Knott, all with us from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office, and Danielle Ponder, also with the office as a diversity and inclusion officer. And they were not only part of what became national marches yesterday on a lot of different fronts, but also with a lot of different public defenders calling for change in the criminal justice system. But they're here talking about what happens going forward, what kind of change can come to get more representation in offices, to get more equity in the results, and what that actually looks like. And let me grab our first phone call. It's Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello, Evan. How are you doing?
Well, again, I wish it were a different subject, my friend, but okay. How are you?
All right. It's interesting to listen to these conversations. One thing that I think I find is that people won't acknowledge the roles that the police departments have always played in keeping the status quo in place, i.e. segregation and all of those type of things, stopping black people in neighborhoods that they don't belong in. Why are you here? All of those things that have these microaggressions by the police are, when I walk and stuff, and I'll notice that sometimes the police will circle around twice. And I laugh to myself. I think to myself, I'm a black man approaching 60, and you guys are still circling around seeing why I'm in this neighborhood. I'm walking on the sidewalk. And those microaggressions constantly keep happening, and all these resources are being used to keep this status quo in place. People won't talk about that, but that's really true. Even in Rochester, right, there's not a city. And people want to believe in the Northeast it's different, but no, there's not a city, there's not a place. That part of what's going on is keeping status quo, is keeping Brighton safe, keeping Pittsburgh safe, making sure that you people don't leave this city. All these type of things that go on constantly. That has to stop. They have to acknowledge that, and they have to deal with that piece. That's part of it, I think. Maybe I'm overreaching, but I really think about that a lot.
I'll ask our guests. Let me start with Catherine. What do you think?
Yeah, if I can, I appreciate that perspective, and I definitely think that that's something that we need to bring to the conversation. And again, that's why I think that it's important for there to be dialogue between these agencies and the communities in which they protect. We all know it. We deal in the reality every single day. We know that there's a status quo. And to be quite frank, that status quo allows them to stay employed. It allows, you know, that house in Brighton to be worth $300,000. They have to create a fear. And then people want to, you know, stay employed. They have to create a justification. But that's the issue here. How are these officers being trained? What information are they going out with and doing these arrests and creating this atmosphere? That's the transparency that we need. When we talk about, well, oh, police officers shouldn't be, you know, responding to, welfare calls. Why shouldn't they? Why aren't we putting more of an expectation on first responders? A police officer is a first responder. We need to know if that police officer is equipped to go into these areas.
Rich, I appreciate that. Anything you want to add there?
And also another thing that we have to realize, this is not a black-white issue when it comes to the police force. The police force, as in its totality, including your minority black officers, in Hispanic office. Many of them are conscious of this, but a lot of them play a role in this too. As you learn, and then as you're around a group of people, you learn that it becomes a group consciousness. And that group consciousness pervades everything. It's not only your white officer. So we have to, and I'm not,
that group,
I can't
that group
say,
consciousness got George Floyd killed.
That's right. So we have to
realize. Respectfully, right. And that's the problem. If we have, people can say, well, there are good officers. If there's a bad officer, and that good officer know that there's a bad officer, that good officer is not a good officer.
That's right. It becomes a group consciousness. And,
right.
And so this has to go throughout the police force, and not only the police force. And to your point, these are peace officers. That's, mm-hmm. that's their role. Just like mm-hmm. as the fires, as the number of fires have gone down because of safeties in buildings, the roles of firemen have changed. Firemen just don't put out fires.
Right.
The same thing has to happen with the police force.
Mm-hmm.
Can I touch on something?
Yeah, please do.
I think it's important to acknowledge that when he talks about the history of the police force, we know that police forces started in the black community as slave patrols, right? And we know that the police force was built on a racist foundation. So the question, Evan, is how do we save a racist institution? How do we save an institution that was created to oversee the black communities? Mm-hmm. The type of policing we have in the black communities does not exist anywhere else. I'm looking at the RPD budget once again. Over one-third of the calls or one-third of the arrests in RPD were discretionary, which means officers initiated that. Now, I don't have the data from Greece or Pittsburgh or any of those other places, but I would bet some money that most of their contact with their community members is when their community members call them. So we have officers who are doing exactly what the police department was historically set up to do, to oversee the black community. And if something is built on a racist foundation, it has to fall. If we remove racism from it, that system has to be dismantled.
Let's get our only break of the hour. I've got a lot of listener feedback, and I also want to talk to our guests about some of what they want to see change within public defenders' offices, starting with, building the ranks of diversity. Essentially, changing the way offices look and who they represent. Our guests are all from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Rob Turner, Catherine Ejimadu, Natalie Knott, Daniel Ponder, and more of your feedback after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're talking harm reduction. During the pandemic, harm reduction means you don't have to lock down entirely. You can add some low level of risk and engage with people, engage with society. But what about in opioids? Is it time for a harm reduction approach there? We'll take a look. In our second hour, a conversation about what equity would look like for black Americans in the healthcare system and beyond. Talk with you Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Andy says, he emails to say, I agree that it is a large expense to prosecute small thefts, but what do we do to protect stores? We should absolutely legalize marijuana. That would be a huge improvement. That seems like a separate issue. But not doing anything about theft will make people not want to do business if it is merely a suggestion to pay for the goods they offer. We worry about disinvestment in our communities. So if we are not going to prosecute petty crimes, we do need a plan to address it. End quote. That comes from Andy. Let me start with Natalie Knott this time. What do you think?
Okay. Well, what I think is most people, most of our clients aren't going into a Walmart and, looking at a pair of shorts just for funsies. Most of what he's calling petty theft is need-based, need-driven, whether these people have substance abuse issues or they simply cannot afford what they need. These are all need-based actions. So I think if we get to the root of these issues and we're able to address these need-based issues, I have clients who are stealing diapers because they simply can't afford diapers. That is not something that needs to be treated
criminally, that should be something that is treated with more cash assistance to support families that, you know, our government claims that they want people to have. And so I think we can't say what we're going to use as criminal solutions until we've actually seen what the world looks like. Once we don't have homeless people, once we don't have hungry people, once we have people who can access chemical dependency treatment in ways other than through the criminal justice system, which is how an overwhelming majority of low income and a lot of working class people are able to access treatment is through the criminal justice system. And that's a real problem. So I don't think that we can say, and I don't think that it's also fair to worry about these corporations that have insurance. They have insurance that covers these losses. And honestly, in the overwhelming majority of petty larceny cases that involve stores, the merchandise is recovered fully. Obviously, there's some cases like food where it can't be used or sold again, but overwhelmingly, the merchandise is recovered. So there are several steps in those areas that I think we need to look at before we can say, okay, this is how we're going to punish this.
Right, and just to piggyback off of that, I'm sorry, but the reality is we're paying attention to the wrong thing. We're talking about, well, how do we protect the corporations? We pay taxes. The corporations are protected, and they get tax benefits, and they're supposed to actually even have an incentive to do for the community that they take up space in. We're talking about people here, all right? But half of the time, like Natalie Ann said, that merchandise is recouped. But you want to continue to prosecute this person when we're not worried about what this person needs. We don't have resources. When people say, well, okay, if they need diapers, well, they can get a job. Or if they have a mental health problem, well, they can, you know, go into a clinic. We have mental health courts. And let me tell you this. There is a wait list out the door. People are clamoring for beds. People are clamoring for agencies. Why don't those agencies have more resources? Why aren't people providing more resources for the real problems and the issues? We're talking about the corporations? They're protected. The people aren't.
That's right.
And I think, you know, just to speak directly to his passion, if he is so concerned about petty larcenies, which many people in our community are concerned with, wouldn't you want to work on the root causes of that problem? If I can tell you that my client going to jail does not stop him when he's released from committing another petty larceny, wouldn't you realize that jail is not effective? I really think it's simpler than people are making it out to be. Every public defender can tell you that it's a revolving door. Commit a petty larceny, go to jail. Commit another petty larceny, go to jail. So if you're really passionate about ending petty larcenies, you should be very passionate about defunding the police and reinvesting into effective strategies for dealing with crime.
Excellent.
Let me ask all of you about the kind of representation that, you know, you think obviously needs to happen, but how you start to get there. And Danielle, you reached out to us because I know it's a concern of yours. What's the current status of representation in public defender's offices, and how do you start to change it?
I mean, I think public defender's office all across the country are struggling with getting folks of color into their office. I will admit up front that you are talking to all the black attorneys. There's actually one more that Rob told me about yesterday. But so we got a whole five of us, an office of more than 70 black attorneys. And all of us can tell you that we walk into a courtroom, everyone is white except the, you know, typically all the lawyers are white, all of the judges in county court, except for one, Karen Bailey Turner, are white, and most of the clients are black or brown. So what I am working on in the public defender's office is looking at colleges and law schools across the country. I'll be going to eight historically black colleges and universities. I'll be looking at affinity organizations, especially downstate. One thing I'm going to try to do is convince people who are paying high rent in Brooklyn to come up and get, you know, you a nice loft downtown in Rochester, New York for $1,200. So it's something that our office is actively working on. And I believe this is the only position, diversity inclusion position, that exists in any Western New York public defender's office. So it's something that it's something that I know Tim Donaher is passionate about. But it's something that I'm also passionate about. I remember being a public defender, and I was the only one, Evan, when I came out of law school, I was the only Black public defender in the criminal bureau in Monroe County Public Defender's office. And that was very isolating for me. I was dealing with things being a Black person and seeing my own people continuously come in and out of court that my colleagues couldn't relate to. So we want to change that climate. I realize it's going to be an uphill battle, but I'm down to do the work.
Let me ask all of our other guests to kind of weigh in on their experience in that regard. I heard you there, Rob Turner. Go ahead.
Yeah, so when I got to the office in 1998, I was the only Black attorney at that time as well. Then more were hired. Some stay, some leave, some go. You have turnover among everyone. But, you know, thankfully, Danielle's been brought on board to pursue this mission, and she's definitely the right person because we do need to have a more representative office in relation to the community, not just attorneys, but also support staff as well. So I know these are things that the office is committed to, and I know this is what Danielle's mission is, and all of us are going to do everything we can to support her.
Okay. Catherine?
Yeah, I just second my colleagues. You know, it's no secret what, you know, Black attorneys go through. It is a struggle every single day. But the mission right now is to bridge the gap between our community, the community that we serve, our Black and brown brothers and sisters. The mission of the Public Defender's Office is a mission that I hold in my heart, and I'm going to see it through. So I am very, you know, interested in bridging that gap, because what matters now is the rights of our clients and that communication piece between us all. So I'm with the Public Defender's Office. They are here for the community, and I'm thankful to be a part of that.
Natalie Knott.
Yes. I don't think you can divorce the idea of money from this equation. Black public defenders, of which the four of us are still Black people. We are still on the wrong end of the racial wealth gap. It is pretty darn hard for you as usually the first person in your family to often the first person in your family to go to college, let alone law school, to then turn around and tell your parents, I took out all these loans, yeah, I'm going to go be a public defender. Especially in an era where loan forgiveness is no longer a certainty for your 10 years of public service. And as public defenders in Monroe County, we do make a good salary. I will not argue with that. But we are still economically significantly farther behind than many of our white colleagues who are able to use their family's generational wealth that their families were able to use. Whereas for most of us, we're the highest earners in our family. In my family, I'm the highest earner my family's basically ever seen. And so when we're trying to diversify offices, we also need to recognize that. We need to recognize that if we want to attract Black attorneys have more economic limitations than a lot of other people. In order for a Black attorney to move from New York City to Rochester, they have to be able to save up enough money to do so. And that's pretty hard when you're living in Brooklyn, even if you are making a decent middle-class salary as a public defender down there. So when we're talking about reallocating funds that are spent on law enforcement, there's a lot of other ways we could spend that money in helping to diversify the public defender's office and diversify all of our agencies that work with clients of color in the city. All of those agencies should reflect the clients they serve. And there's many ways to incentivize that or to provide financial assistance to allow people to take these types of jobs, whether it's for relocating or to help with student loan payments, which the state of New York does offer, but I can say for everyone is not nearly enough considering the burdens we take on financially. Mm-hmm. Additionally, I would love people to go look at the RPD budget and look how much the average officer gets in overtime compared to public defenders who are not eligible for that at all. No matter how many hours we work preparing a trial or on trial or when we have dockets in the town courts that go until 10 o'clock at night. So these are things to think about. It really is a dollars and cents issue as much as it is a mission issue.
That's a great point.
Amy in Rochester on the phone is next. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
good. I just wanted to make the comment that I was listening to the portion about the petty larcenies and those crimes being prosecuted. I just wanted to say that I personally have been through drug court, and Rochester and Monroe County specifically responded to that issue with creating drug court, with creating sex trafficking court, with creating veterans court and mental health court. And I was given the options for multiple petty larceny to choose drug court or to take a short sentence in jail. And most people are given that option. I chose drug court because I wanted the treatment. But drug court is very strenuous, and most people don't choose it. They take the short jail sentence. Those options are there. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I would love to answer that.
Oh, so we can respond?
We all have something to say about that.
Go ahead.
Me.
I think I heard Natalie first. Go ahead, Natalie.
Okay. So drug court can be a great program for people who are ready for that. However, just because you got arrested, on a $15 petty larceny does not mean, first of all, prior to bail reform, often if you did want to go to drug court, it meant you would have to sit in jail until you were able to go to drug court and be taken into the court and have a treatment plan set up for you. Luckily now with bail reform, if you do have a petty larceny, that won't be the case. But that was the case up until January 1st of this year. However, using the threat of a cage is not an optimal way to get someone to recover from being addicted to drugs. That is right. That is not how this should be treated. That is not how this should be done. And just because someone gets arrested on a $15 petty larceny does not mean that they are ready to go into treatment that is conditioned on their compliance or they go to jail. That is the reality of drug court. You comply with your treatment plan. You do everything you're supposed to, or you can be, there are obviously a couple of sanction steps in between that require you to come to court and sit there, meaning that can be very disruptive to people trying to stabilize a job. But ultimately, the threat of failure in drug court is jail. And that is not a way we should be treating addiction. Addiction is a public health issue. It is not something that should be treated through the criminal justice system. Even if someone has committed a crime, a petty larceny, we'll say.
The only thing I want to say in response to that is, I'm sorry, Danielle, did you want to go? I know I've been skipping people. You can go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
The only thing that I wanted to point out and just kind of delve in the truth, because, again, we are public defenders. We go to court each and every day. We know our judges. We know our system. We even know the offers before the offers are presented to us. And the reality is, I don't know what statistics she's reading from, is everyone is not presented with those same opportunities. You heard very clear that Danielle stated that she had a client, and after his umpteenth stay in jail, they finally figured out, well, maybe we should give him some other, resources, maybe mental health court or drug treatment court. And I want to bet my bottom dollar that Miss Amy is maybe one of my lighter skin friends. So all Black people, all brown people are not presented with the same opportunities, even in the same situations, at our lighter skin brothers and sisters. So let me make that very clear.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
I just wanted to add that I think that when we're talking about shifting the paradigms, we have to ask ourselves the deeper questions. What she's really saying is she got treatment and she got help, but that treatment did not have to go through the criminal justice system. And when white folks were addicted, are still addicted to heroin in high numbers, our district attorney created a completely different program called Project Hope, which would allow them not to even enter the court system. The police could take those individuals and redirect them to rehabilitation centers. So that has already happened for young white folks who were addicted to heroin. So to even suggest that this is something that, oh my God, how could we possibly? These structures have already happened in the opiate crisis. They've already changed for certain individuals. But I completely want to say I'm so happy she got the help she needs, and she can get that help without the criminal justice system.
Definitely.
Rob, did you want to add to that?
No, I think Daniel summed it up quite nicely.
Okay, well, I truly wish we had another hour here, but I think it's important, and I will just put this out there for all four of our guests here. I think the coming weeks and months, because I know it feels like a sprint, but there will be parts that are a sprint and parts that are a marathon when there's talk of reform and change. But it will take some time. And I hope we can check back and you know, frankly, steal some more of your time. I know you're all very busy, and I greatly appreciate it, but I hope you'll come back, because I don't want this conversation and these related conversations to be, well, you know, George Floyd was murdered, the country talked about things for a couple of weeks, and then everything went back to where it was. I feel like this is a moment where we can build a moment into just a series of actual tangible events to allow people to continue to access what change might look like. And I hope you can come back. I just want to put it out there. I hope you all will. I appreciate it very
much. Would
love
to, Evan.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Danielle, since you reached out, 20 seconds here, do you find yourself more or less optimistic that tangible change is actually within reach now?
Evan, you know I'm cynical, but I got to say, I got a lot of hope. I feel it. I feel the power of the people. I think this is an exciting time, and it's a pivotal moment, and it's going to happen.
Daniel Ponder, Natalie Knott, Catherine Ejimadu, Rob Turner, all with us from the Monroe County Public Defender's Office, sharing their experience, their expertise, their thoughts on possible reform and change, and some of the history that should instruct us as we think about why things are the way they are and what might change them. Thanks to all four of you, and I do hope we can talk maybe a few weeks out. Let's do this again, and let's keep our eyes on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
A wonderful conversation with them, and appreciate all of the listeners who've interacted with us today. I know sometimes it can be tiring, and there's a lot to do, but let's keep at it, and let's keep pushing this program and pushing me and the whole team here. Rob Braden, Megan Mack, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.